Welcome to Garden Talk by Walter Anderson Nursery, hosted by Ken Anderson, George Allman, and John Clements of Drab to Fab Landscaping. Garden Talk aims to introduce new ideas to help solve problems and keep you up to date on the latest development in the nursery and landscape industry. For a podcast of today's program and others, visit walteranderson.com and click on the podcast tab. Now, here's your host.
Good morning, San Diego. You are listening to Garden Talk here on KCBQ and K-Praise, KPRZ. I'm George Allman along with John Clements. Ken Anderson is out for the day, so we are going to be with you for the next hour talking to you about all kinds of things going on in your yard and garden. Question for us, or would like to comment on the show, or have a suggestion, or a topic or guest that you would like to hear about, you can email us at gardentalk@walteranderson.com. And remember, that's S-E-N on Anderson. Or follow us on the Walter Anderson Nursery main Facebook page. And we do have classes today in San Diego. It is Camellias 101 with Constance. And in San Diego, it's Water-Wise Gardening, how much and how often to water your plants. And that's with local author Rich Restuccia, who you may have may recall listened to a couple of weeks ago. John, good morning.
Good morning, George. I love Constance. Do you know I gave her her first job in horticulture in San Diego?
I did not know that.
I don't know, 25-ish years ago, probably.
You know, a lot of the time he's when we talk on here, you and Ken go back decades and decades and decades.
We're old.
I'm just as old. I came to California, though, in 1979. Mm. So anyway, with that, we do have a special guest with us today. We have Brooke Sarson. Brooke is the owner of a local company called Catching H2O, and she's going to be with us for the next hour talking about rainwater and water reclamation, not reclamation, but catching water for rain and how to best utilize the water in your yard. And so with that, let's welcome Brooke.
Thanks, George. I'm glad to be here.
Tell us about yourself. First off, how did you get into this business?
Well, back in 2008, there was a big drought and I was an engineer at the time, but
civil engineer?
Actually, no, electrical.
Okay, all right.
So this is just a complete diversion from that. But I wanted to do something that mattered and was important. And when I kind of came to it, it was water. And looking around other places in the world, other places in the U.S., there's a lot more resilience built into communities with water, where people have their own, you know, rainwater tanks or gray water systems. And it's part of the community effort as well. And, you know, I didn't feel like our leaders were really talking about that aspect of it. They were talking about building more dams and, you know, creating larger water infrastructure projects. So I just wanted to learn more about that and help educate my community. And I've been doing it ever since. I was in partnership with Rosalind Hasselbeck to start Catching H2O in 2017. And she recently retired, so now it's me and my amazing team at Catching H2O, putting in rainwater tanks and gray water systems all over the county and Orange County and Riverside County, actually.
It's expanded quite a bit.
Yeah, definitely.
Well, that's awesome. Mm-hmm. Now, John, you know Brooke. You've worked with her in some capacity.
Yeah, with Grab to Fab. We do projects together, and Brad Lefkowitz, I know, uses mm-hmm. her company. And mm-hmm. so, yeah, Brooke's company has, and a lot of people that I have done consultations for through the years, they all sing your praises.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Thanks.
Well, so you do consultation. And mm-hmm. what does that entail?
Consultations are kind of our design practice, where I think a lot of people come to this and they think, I want a rainwater tank. But there's a lot more factors involved in that, which is, you know, even understanding how much water is your roof generating. Where can you fit rainwater capture? There's some unique ways to capture rainwater that a lot of people don't know about that can make it more efficient and effective. How much rainwater do you need for your plants? And then going into even sometimes gray water is an even more economical return as far as like dollars per gallon. And so just kind of assessing what the feasibility for those. So it's kind of like doing an on-site water mapping and figuring out like the best ways to apply your on-site water resources. Sometimes it's AC condensate, and some people want a rainwater tank, but they don't realize they would be saving way more money if they just improved their irrigation system. So, you know, you don't even need to spend the money on a rainwater tank to kind of get water saving. So I think just understanding all of that, and that's what a consultation accounts for. Sometimes it's people with a new build, or they're going to do a remodel and they just need help talking to the other contractors on site or a new landscape and just how everything's going to integrate, because gray water is not only understanding plumbing, but it's also understanding how water is used in the landscape and how this dirty water, quote unquote, is useful for your plants or not, depending on what kind of plants. So making those connections between the right professionals, that's kind of where we fit in as well. So we do, you know, full installations, but a lot of our work is really about educating consumers.
I saw that you did installation, you do maintenance and obviously sales for tanks and such, right?
Yeah, we do tank sales, just kind of, that's just part of the deal. But maintenance, I mean, it's really interesting. I mean, we've done probably over 1,000 installs at this point along the way. And so we have, you know, almost 20 years of knowledge of these systems and how they work. And so we've been using our maintenance program to basically constantly be improving the strategies that we employ so that people are getting really high quality. We don't want to install stuff that's going to break because we're in the sustainability field. We don't want to like put in stuff that's going to break in 5 years. So we want things to last. And so the maintenance program has been a really good way for us to map. Because it's such a unique field, we don't have a lot of other, you know, instances to draw from. And so seeing our work and maybe some others that have installed over the years or people that do it themselves, we can say like what works and doesn't work. But keeping these systems working is what makes them last.
Did you have a question, John?
Yeah. So that's an interesting concept to think about, maintenance on rainwater tanks and on gray water systems. So what's entailed on maintaining these?
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, there's some systems that are just very simple, right? It's like your washing machine water is just ejecting out into the landscape, kind of pooling in areas that are benefiting your trees. But there are places that can get clogged, you know, like the end of pipes. If, you know, if they're not protected, mulch can break down. These are, you know, a lot of our gray water is going into mulch basins, and the mulch basins are essentially like sponges that allow the water to kind of flood into. It holds onto the water. But if all that mulch breaks down, it can get compacted and then the water can start to pool and get stinky.
You made a stinky face, by the way, while you did that.
I mean, when I say stinky, gray water can get real stinky. Right. I mean, ideally, you're using it well in your landscape and it's not an issue, but that's what maintenance for. So at its simplest, it could be things like that, but we also have pumped systems. So there's, you know, checking on pumps, there's filters involved in rainwater capture, for example, that where the water comes out of the downspout into filters that then drain into the tanks. Keeping these clean is an important way to ensure that the water can keep getting into your tanks. It's an important way to make sure that the water that does get into your tank stays clean. Anybody who's had a 55-gallon barrel collecting straight from a downspout will tell you how stinky that water gets if it's held for too long. It's got leaves and bacteria and, you know, all kinds of stuff in there. So those are just a few key maintenance points.
You offer, in addition to the services you do at locations, you offer classes as well, right? For like water harvesting certificates.
Yeah.
What does that entail and what does that get me if I were to get a water harvesting certificate?
Well, Drab to Fab owners Kurt and Alec have gotten their water harvesting certificate, as well as you mentioned Brad Lefkowitz from Waves Landscaping. Some others have also gotten it. I mean, it's not like board certified or anything like that. It's something I've developed from just my years of doing this, that to help people, whether it's homeowners or professionals. I've had plumbers, architects, landscapers, all kinds of people taking that course. And it's basically a comprehensive body of knowledge to help people if they want to get involved in this, if they want to do it themselves, if they want to help their clients, to at least have a better understanding, a deeper understanding of these opportunities, not only through coursework, homework, tests, but also on like on-site work, getting under houses. And it's just like, that's a comprehensive version of all the other classes that I've created over the years. You know, this Saturday, for example, we have a rainwater tank installation class. But those are the kinds of things that, you know, just helping people have more accessibility to this knowledge because it's not rocket science. Like, you don't have to be a contractor to be able to put a lot of these systems together. And when I started, this was what I most wanted, was to help people feel empowered.
Well, with that, you know, you do offer do-it-yourself support, right? So if I, you said I don't have to be a rocket scientist or an engineer. So if I wanted to put a rain tank in, I can reach out to you guys and you would give us insight, support.
Yeah, sometimes people just need some help with planning, like, right. Well, what's possible here? And so once we talk about what's possible, we have like some DIY material on our website that they can either look at or purchase, depending on some of the technical aspects, like putting in a gray water valve assembly and then describing how the distribution needs to happen in the yard. And they're perfectly happy shoveling and, you know, doing some outside PVC work, and we can walk away. And so it just depends on your level of comfortability with the information and the technical work.
You mentioned your website. You want to give it to everybody?
It's catchingh2o.com, and it's the letter O, because H2O is and hydrogen and oxygen.
And the number two.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. We'll put that on our, we did put it on our website for you in regards to a class. So it's there.
Thanks. Yep.
Well, you know, thinking about doing gray water systems, it definitely pays to start from the beginning of construction on your house, because so many of us in Southern California live in older houses that have slabs. And so what do you do in a case like that if you want to do gray water?
Yeah, this is a really great question. And I never like to tell somebody you don't have the opportunity at all. Laundry gray water is usually something everybody can do regardless of if they're on a slab or not. And we can go into details if we want to. If you have a second floor, sometimes you can still get to the water from a floor, the ceiling. And then if you're doing a remodel of a bathroom, that would be a good time to be able to, you know, get through the concrete and put a three-way valve that allows water to get outside to the garden. So those are the only times. Or I always tell people, put in an outdoor shower. Just start taking your showers outside. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, yeah, getting it in during construction. And the city of Encinitas requires gray water stub outs on all new construction.
Well, let's pick up on that right after this break. We're going to take a short break and we'll be right back.
There's more Garden Talk on the way. Welcome back to Garden Talk by Walter Anderson Nursery. Here's your hosts, Ken Anderson, George Allman, and John Clements.
And good morning. We are back from our break. This is George Allman with John Clements and our special guest, Brooke Sarson from Catching H2O. Ken is off today. So with that, we're going to pick back up where we left off on gray water. Brooke, it's yours.
Yeah. So the city of Encinitas is now requiring all new development to have gray water stub outs. Unfortunately, a lot of contractors will put in a gray water stub out to appease the code, but that gray water stub out becomes either really expensive to then adapt for gray water or almost impossible. You know, if they start paving over that area, we can't get a tank in there. If it's very deep, we have to put a really big tank underground to be able to, you know, pump it out to other places. You don't store gray water. So we're not talking, when I'm talking about a surge tank or a tank for gray water, it's a surge tank. It's not a storage tank. And most people are really confused about how to use the water in their garden. So, there's easy ways to do it, which is like flood irrigating, but it requires a very specific landscape style. And then there's the more complicated, but more traditional landscape, which would require drip, which requires a very expensive gray water system that has, you know, certain kinds of pump and lots of filtration that needs to be maintained regularly. So getting in early to that process is really important. But I think, great, you know, requiring the stub out is a really big step in kind of the right direction. It's just we need a lot more education in the community to understand how to properly do that, to help people actually implement gray water systems.
But in general, is the easiest way to just have it flood an area when you're using gray water?
Yeah. I would say it depends on the volume. Like if you have a whole house gray water system, that's a lot of water
sure.
on a daily basis. And it's a lot of water to spread by flooding. So it really does depend. I mean, if you have like a big landscape and you have a good slope and you can recreate swales on contour and just have water flood in there and you have good percolation. So it's all going to be kind of like moving underground subsurface. You can touch a lot of root systems on the way. But it's not the way that most landscapers like to think about irrigation because you're not meting out a specific dose of water per plant. It's a more natural kind of ecological situation. So it just doesn't work in every situation.
Well, and also when it comes to landscape irrigation, you want to go around each individual plant 360 degrees, you know, the totality of the root ball. And if you're flood irrigating, you're just getting water from one side. And so that makes
I would think, wouldn't that depend on the berm and how the swells,
the
you
know, berms,
yeah, I think yeah. you can, because I only water in our irrigation on our fruit trees. Mm-hmm. I have a single bubbler in every tree, mm-hmm. but it floods. It's a basin. And so, yes, the water's here, but it percolates and I have it at 360. Mm. At least I think I do know all the trees, the trees are all doing well. So yes, it does work. I think that also there's a big concern, obviously, with gray water, right? We're putting potential chemicals if someone's using bleach and also E. coli and things like that. So what are the precautions and how does one mitigate that?
Yes, these are all kind of spelled out in Chapter 15 of the California Plumbing Code, kind of in more of a technical way of what to avoid sort of thing. But things that are required is that you do need to have the ability to divert back to the sewer or septic system. For those instances where you will be putting something down there that you don't want that's on your plants.
That's the three-way valve you were speaking of?
Yeah.
Okay.
That you release the water subsurface. It needs to be released under at least 2 inches of something. We recommend mulch. Some people maybe put gravel, but I don't recommend that because it's hard to clean. But mulch allows you to keep a healthy microbiology essentially in the soil where all those, little critters can chew up whatever dead skin and, hair and whatever else gets down the drain. It actually becomes food that creates nutrients for your plants. Soaps are not in general bad for your plants. They actually have things like nitrogen, potassium, and phosphorus. So you're getting free fertilizer. But some things that soaps have that are bad for your plants, which is not something that's being regulated, but it's more just like a best practice, is a lot of salt or sodium. Mm-hmm. So even products like Seventh Generation, if you look at their ingredients list, there's sodium listed many, mm-hmm. many times, and it's 50 ingredients long, and you're like, well, where do you find this in nature? Mm-hmm. And I know you guys are on the same page as me, but I think of our plants the way I think of our bodies. Mm-hmm. It's like, I'm not going to go to the store and buy something with 50 unknown chemical ingredients mm-hmm. to put in my kids. I don't mm-hmm. want to do that to my plants either. Mm-hmm. So just finding products that have fewer ingredients, finding products that maybe list salt or sodium only once, mm-hmm. Things that have more natural ingredients that you can identify, like, if it's lavender, mm-hmm. not something else. Things that have less, perfumes and dyes yeah. and things like that. But salts are kind of a little bit inevitable. They keep it shelf stable. They are softening agents. They're sudsing agents. And so they make us feel like our clothes are getting cleaner. But for the most part, if you have a healthy soil system, it could be a non-issue. But if you have really heavy clay soil, like most of our mid-city, and you're sending out a lot of salts on top of the city water, then it could become problematic.
Hmm. Are there problems with fats? A lot of soaps contain fat or oils of different kinds. Does that digest all right?
I think for the quantity you're putting in, if you're doing like shampoos or conditioners mm-hmm. or, laundry soap, it's a non-issue. But this is why kitchen sinks specifically are not considered gray water. They're considered black water. Hmm. Because the excess amount of fats do build up in sure. the soil right. and create like a film that just okay. becomes impenetrable. And if you were to do that, it would have to be maintained a lot more frequently, which is nobody really does. Mm-hmm. They're not going to dig out a gray water basin, a few times a year. So it's better to avoid that kind of thing.
And I love my Tide Pods, I have to say. I just like the way I get dirty. I get so dirty. And so I've tried some of the more organic, you know, clothes soaps, and I find the Tide Pods just make it clean and make it smell good. So am I completely off the chart with putting that into a gray water system?
Well, actually, what you're bringing up is another interesting question I get asked, which is about microplastics.
Mm.
And so people say, well, what happens when I don't want microplastics in my garden?
Right.
Well, if you're using Tide Pods, you must not mind those in the ocean either. So, you know, it's kind of like this slippery backyard, what you want to see for the world. And so I think that there's also like breeze sheets and stuff like that. But I think mm-hmm. those aren't going to do the work that you want them to do. Mm-hmm. But you could do something like if you do 5 loads of laundry a week, maybe one load is the Tide Pod load with like the really heavy duty stuff, and that goes to the sewer. And then the rest of the mm-hmm. loads are with your good soap that then gets to go out to your landscape. Also, I would say your landscape probably has really amazing soil, and it can probably handle whatever you throw at it.
Mm-hmm. I was concerned when you were talking about loving Tide Pods that you were not eating them.
Some kind of TikTok challenge or something.
Okay. No. Just make sure we're on track.
That's very unhealthy.
It's not good for you. It's not good for you. With regard to using gray water and, you know, all the caveats you just gave us, are there restrictions on edible crops? What's the law say for edible crops with regard to gray water?
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, let's not talk about the law right now, but let's just talk about best practices. Because if it says something like no edible foods, that's a misnomer. You can definitely spread gray water around fruit tree root zones. There's not any concern about bacteria climbing right. all the way up the tree into the fruits that you're going to eat. Likewise, you could do other kinds of crops, especially if you have the water spreading really underneath a mulch basin and you don't have the edible parts of the food anywhere near that mulch basin. So you can get into passion fruit vines, tomato vines, corn, you know, climbing vine really, or other kind of maybe perennials like artichokes, anything like that are fine. But not anything you're going to eat the root of. So no potatoes, no carrots, things like that. And probably not any leafy greens or other kind of close to the surface growing plants. Like I probably wouldn't do a lot of brassicas. I might do like a really big tree collard I wouldn't have a problem with, but maybe not just lower growing stuff. And herbs, you know, like we can do maybe some rosemary and things like that. But if you're going to be doing mint, you know, that's a very right. like water heavy plant and it grows near the ground. And I wouldn't necessarily do that. So you don't want to put anything that's coming into contact with bacteria laden water in your mouth. But the gray water is amazing for all of those plants. And if you're going to go to the trouble of investing in a gray water system, what better way than to get double your return by growing food that you can then eat? But some plants have more sensitivity to the salt content, for example, of the gray water.
Avocados, John,
yes.
salt.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah.
Blueberries, yeah. you know, things like that, that you really want to just be mindful of the plants, you know, soil preference.
You shied away from the law. Are there laws with regard to gray water on plants?
Not in the plumbing code. Okay. I think there are some places like where, you know, maybe a city has some gray water kind of rules, like brief rules, and it'll say no edible plants, but it's not the law as such. It's just like what their limited understanding is of what gray water is and what it isn't. They're kind of trying to protect themselves. So I think it's a case by case basis. It's education is what we really need among the community.
And you do that.
That's what we do.
Like the part of your company, one of your big headers on your website is education.
Yeah.
And you're doing it right now as well.
We do.
So what are the tanks made of that you're using? We worry about plastics. And then I think, you know, a big tank in the hot sun. And what does that do to the water quality? And I'd love to hear about what the product materials are.
Yeah. Of. For rainwater tanks, unfortunately, the most cost-effective tanks are plastic and round. So people want to do metal, people want to do, you know, concrete. Those are all options, but they're a lot more expensive. So big round plastic tanks above ground is the most economical, and they are BPA free. They are for potable drinking water. So people do store potable quality water in these tanks. They're often used in agricultural settings for other things, but as long as it's resistant, and they're, you know, thick enough that they are UV resistant, and they have darker colors. So people use 55 gallon barrels and stuff like that. Those are not really generally UV resistant, and they will be food safe, but not probably meant for outdoor purposes. So food safe is like they have some kind of Coke syrup or something like shoved in a warehouse.
Okay. And with that, we'll pick up right after we take this short break. We'll be right back with Brooke Sarson from Catching H2O right after this break.
There's more Garden Talk on the way. Welcome back to Garden Talk by Walter Anderson Nursery. Here's your hosts, Ken Anderson, George Allman, and John Clements.
And we are back. You're listening to Garden Talk in San Diego here on K-Praise and KCBQ. I'm George Allman with John Clements and our special guest, Brooke Sarson from Catching H2O. Ken has the day off. And Brooke, before we went into break, we were talking about John's question regarding plastics in the water storage. So if you want to continue expanding on that.
Yeah. So, I mean, the tanks or cisterns themselves, you can also build structures to protect them, like trellises. You could put them on the north sides of buildings to just keep them from the hottest part of the sun. They generally have like a 25-year UV rating. So the more you protect them, the longer it's going to last. I know some people in different climates go to the trouble of actually maybe surrounding them by like a cob or some, you know, like cob material, like a adobe material, just to kind of make them last forever, because then they're totally protected. But yeah, I mean, at the end of the day, it's a plastic tank. So I think we have a lot of that kind of stuff in our society right now. And we just have to figure out like what's the highest, best use of that kind of material. And, you know, how do we make these systems last for as long as possible?
When I traveled around Australia, they had a lot of the farms had big metal cisterns and or tanks. Is that not cost effective, or does it not last long enough?
We have a lot of those. Actually, if you go out anywhere like East County, you'll see a lot of that. They're mostly for fire protection. And they do that for wells sometimes, where you'll pump the water from a well into a big 5,000 gallon tank that then feeds into the whole house or something. So it's not uncommon here, but it is a lot more costly. The advantage of metal tanks is that you, instead of transporting a really large tank, which 5,000 gallons is about the biggest plastic tank you can transport around, you can get into the 10,000, 20,000, 30,000 gallon range in a single tank, which you obviously have to have a lot of area for that, because it just comes in metal sheets, and then they get either riveted or you know, soldered together or whatever. Some of the downfalls of that is you probably should still have a plastic liner if this is going to be for a rainwater capture. Rainwater just is so pure, it's trying to like find balance, and so it will like leach the metals out of, and you know, eventually that metal tank will also degrade. But they have longer lifespans, I think much longer lifespans. You usually have to put in a concrete foundation, probably even have to pull a permit for that. So there's just added cost for sure with that.
Are those best for wells, or can they work really well on a larger property here with rainwater capture off of roofs?
Oh yeah. Yeah, they can definitely. We put in a couple of those, but like I said, they're much more expensive. So they're, you know, probably 4 times to 10 times more expensive. I mean, it becomes more cost effective if you get really, really large storage, like over 30,000 gallons. And that's happening a lot in like Texas. But for us, the kinds of ranges that we're seeing people putting in, it's actually just a lot more costly. But they're better looking in a lot of cases.
I think so. Yeah, I think they look a lot better.
Yeah.
One of the challenges we have, and John, I know we've spoken about this before, is, you know, we have a rain season. So you put all this money into this 10,000 gallon or 3,000 gallon tank, or even, you know, a couple hundred gallon tanks. You capture all that water December 2nd when we have a nice little rain, and you don't need it till March, right? Or April or May, because it's raining. And so all that water just sits there. Now, obviously you can use it and then it's going to fill again, but you really didn't need it unless you're watering plants that are inside your house. So how does it become cost effective if I'm only using, you know, this amount of water once because it's raining the rest of the time? I get to use it in May when the sun comes out and it's not raining.
Yeah, it's really interesting when you go through the individual design process and each individual home. But what I tend to find, at least in the more urban parts of San Diego, is that people don't generally have enough space to store as much water as they possibly could. So they're catching, you know, 10, 20,000 gallons off of their roof, but they can really only hold, you know, 1,000 gallons or maybe 5,000 gallons. So when you kind of think about your use, I mean, even though it all rains, it only rains in the winter, we do have gaps in rain. And if you have a really drought tolerant landscape, you're not going to need any water. But a lot of people are growing food, you know, a lot of veggies and all of that kind of stuff. So that's the kind of stuff, if you're really going hard with growing like all winter long, then you can cycle that water. Now you're getting, you know, turning a 5,000 gallon system into a 10,000 gallon system or more because you're using it all winter. And in the winter, at least, you're not drawing from, you know, you could possibly avoid drawing from municipal resources altogether for outdoor use.
Keeping your overall water bill down.
Exactly.
And then use it in the summer when, yeah.
Exactly. And even if you're not using the water in the winter specifically, you probably don't have enough water. You're probably not able to store enough water to really keep your whole landscape irrigated all summer long anyways. So it's really about being strategic what you're going to use it for. And so, you know, for example, rainwater is really the most amazing resource for veggies or other kinds of things that are really sensitive to salts, like the avocados or the blueberries, or if you grow orchids or, you know, other kinds of things. So keeping it just aside for the most special thing in your yard or the thing that you really don't want to die if, you know, we get drought restrictions. Otherwise, thinking about it more strategically, like, you know, sometimes our fruit trees, it's like they start limping along by the end of the summer because they're just like on a city water diet or a well water diet. And maybe giving them like a good deep watering with rainwater a couple times in the summer helps to like clear the soils and give them an added boost. So I think there's ways to be strategic about it. And even though you can't catch everything you need or have room to store everything you want, then you can still have good strategies for really supporting your little ecosystem.
Now, I know that with the gray water systems, you're doing gravity feed and just having that go into swales and things like that. Is it different with the rainwater? Are you using a pump and then putting it into a drip system, let's say, or distributing by MP rotors with a pump? Or how are you doing it differently with rainwater versus gray water?
Yeah, well, the big difference between rainwater and gray water is that gray water cannot be stored, so it has to be used regularly. So whether it's by flood or by pump, you know, that can all happen. With rainwater, you can absolutely tie it into your irrigation system. It's just the cost benefit. You know, it's like you don't want to go to all of that trouble because pumps, there's filters, there's plumbing changes, you need maybe special controller that can, you know, work with a master valve per zone or whatever it is. Then you don't want to do all of that work if you have like a 500 gallon tank and it's all going to go away in 1 week or a day. So really those systems start to make more sense if you can store more water. So we just put in a system, you know, for example, this week, and it was 5,300 gallons of water. There was no point in bringing the whole entire roof into that because it was going to fill up so fast. So half the roof goes into earthworks in the ground and then half the roof goes to that tank system, but it's also not much water relative to the entire yard. So we said, absolutely not. We will not water the lawn with this very precious water because that's just going to get rid of all this water in a second. So it's going to more peripheral plants that are more drought tolerant, you know, some fruit trees, things like that. And so that's kind of the way to make it stretch. But it became more worth it, especially as it being done at the ground level of this landscape rather than trying to like rework a bunch of stuff, you know, later on. So I think those are some key ways to get the distribution in a way that makes sense. But we do have some gravity feed. Like if you have a 500 gallon tank and you're pretty involved in your garden, I would say going out, like turning your irrigation down to 2 days a week and then going out 1 day a week and hand watering with that limited water supply is a good way to kind of, you know, keep the veggies happy and, you know, be using your rainwater. So I think there's strategies that you can apply no matter where you're at in that spectrum.
You, on your website, you had mentioned that you focus on cisterns versus barrels. What are the differences? What is a cistern compared to a barrel?
Well, a cistern by, I guess, the city of San Diego, or I don't know if it was Metropolitan Water District, kind of started to pioneer this specific, like a cistern is anything that captures of more than 200 gallons. In other places, a cistern would be referred to when it was underground storage.
That's how I always knew.
Yeah. So yes, I think just the nomenclature is a little, you know, depends who you talk to. But I definitely like to stay away from the word barrel. I think barrels are a waste of money and resources. But barrels would be, you know, 55 gallons, 75 gallons, 35 gallons, kind of all those free giveaway things they give you. That has one will probably tell you it fills up in a hot second. You know, it overflows. It's a mess. It's hard to use. Like the water doesn't come out very efficiently. It's stinky. It's high maintenance. Whatever. I've heard it all from everybody. So I kind of stay above the 200 gallon range. There's a particular tank, a line of tanks, Bushman, and they have a 200 gallon rainwater storage tank that's really well outfitted for capturing rainwater off of a roof. You know, it's got 3-inch inlet, 3-inch overflow, which is the kind of volume you would see from a standard downspout in a peak event. Anything smaller, like the 1-inch or whatever, is just going to be inundated and kind of get messy. And then being able to tie in really good connections to the tank so you can use the water really well. But anybody, again, you'd start doing the calculations off a roof and even that will fill up very quickly. So I think just staying away from barrels, no matter what anybody tells you, is my mantra.
Do you do cisterns? I mean, in ground, what I would consider a cistern, a 10,000 gallon in ground system.
We have done some. I try to avoid, kind of proposing that to people. Some people want it, but when you see the price difference, then you might make accommodation for some other options. Like if you have an acre, finding a place for a 5,000 gallon above ground tank is not a really big deal. And there's no point in going to the trouble of spending, you know, 4 to 10 times more than that to put in underground. Maybe when you're developing a property would be a good time if it can go under a driveway or under a lawn. Those are some good times, but there's always problems, you know, even if it's above ground or below ground, it's like, what do you want to maintain? You know, what are the worst things that can happen? You have the ground shifting, you have things that kind of can break, you get root infiltration. I mean, obviously you want to try and, you know, install it as well as possible. But there's always things, you know, so I just try and I'm like, if you want this to last forever, just that would not be what I would recommend. Okay. And it's very expensive.
I would imagine so, and probably a lot of permits as well. Okay, we're going to take a short break. We'll be right back right after this.
There's more Garden Talk on the way. Welcome back to Garden Talk by Walter Anderson Nursery. Here's your hosts, Ken Anderson, George Allman, and John Clements.
And we are back. This is George Allman with John Clements. Ken has the day off, and we are going to pick right back up with Brooke Sarson from Catching H2O. Brooke, I have a question. In the beginning, you had mentioned condensate and other water sources in addition to gray water. What are they, and how do we utilize those?
Yeah, I think if you take a walk around your property or around other people's property in your neighborhood or your friend's properties, you might start to notice there's little pipes sticking out of the walls in weird places. And maybe there's moisture patches in various spots around. And these could come from any number of places. I mean, there's AC condensate. So obviously that's only going to be generated, you know, if you're using the air conditioner, but a lot of people have mini splits. So there's also, you know, it happens in the winter and summer. You can get that same kind of effect from your water heaters. Some water heaters also produce a condensate. There's whole house filters that have automatic flushes that maybe once a week or every other week will flush like 20 gallons or something to clean the filters. And sometimes it's a water softener, so you don't really want to use that water because it's full of sodium, but sometimes you can transition it to potassium. There's also, well, a lot of people in, especially in mid-city, there's a lot of water that collects under people's houses. And so they have like sumps that will actually evacuate the water to the road, you know, as it accumulates. And sometimes that's happening all summer long. And sometimes that's happening because of irrigation that's going on around the house that's keeping this the clay saturated, and it's just oozing in under houses. And so the water is continually being pumped. So just keeping your eye on all of those kinds of things. A lot of times, a lot of those utilities are also kind of in the garage area with the washing machine. So we'll just tie them in directly with a washing, like gray water system, so that all that water can just get out to spread to the same planting areas. So it's really just understanding the water quality. AC condensate is amazing water quality. Sometimes if the pipe's high up, we can even send it directly into downspouts or gutters that lead into rainwater tanks. So they're storing more water in the summer when they're not collecting rain. They're collecting AC condensate to keep their water systems full or filling. And but some of that you don't want to store, like the reverse or the water softeners and stuff. You don't want to store that water, but you do want it to be able to be distributed out to the landscape. A lot of, I think the fundamental thing that a contractor will do when he's building is it'll just be pointing down or out right at the base of your building. And so that's where there's hardscaping, pavers, no plants. You know, you really don't want to keep the areas around your foundation saturated. So really moving it away from the foundation is a good idea. And why not water plants with it?
You had mentioned just being observant and vigilant. I have a lake near my house. Is there a way I can tap into that?
You probably are tapped into it. It's probably going into the city of San Diego water supply or something like that. I think when I find people that, you know, have seasonal streams, for example, running through their properties, or, you know, maybe water coming off of the roads nearby that they want to bring into their properties, I always caution people about that. There's so much water that you already have available that you're generating on site that is probably more economical for you to capture those resources first than kind of trying to bring in these outside resources. Plus, you have the potential for creating catastrophe. I mean, when you have like water flowing seasonally, it can be a lot of water. It can overwhelm your property. And plus the water quality is not as good as, for example, water coming off your roof, because now it's collecting not only sediment and things like that, but you've got, you know, animal feces, and if it's bringing in stormwater from other properties, you could have pesticides and things like that. So you don't necessarily want to bring in outside water to your property unless you have like a ton of property and, you know, have places that you can just kind of collect or sink it into in the ground. But I would focus on your own property first. And by the time you do the calculations of how much water you're shedding off your roofs, how much water you can grab from your gray water, you probably have more than you can already control or harvest.
I have tanks at my other house, that my old rental property that we used successfully over years. And I typically used it on the plants that were most sensitive because, you know, as I was alluding to earlier, sometimes you just can't use it in the winter, but it makes a huge difference on avocados. And I know, John, we've talked in the past, we were at the National Botanic Garden in DC. They grow avocados and citrus, but they're inside and they're using, you know, quality water, not the end of the Colorado River water. And the avocados look spectacular. The citrus doesn't have any citrus leaf miner. Everything looks really good because of the quality of the water and rainwater. That if we could capture it and reuse it here, I think our plants would, and I know you talk about it a lot, John, our plants would be so much happier and they would look a lot better. But there's a cost to it. Right? Capturing all that water and then being able to distribute it.
Yeah, I find that the people that are, I wouldn't say across the board, but I would say a high percentage of people that are most interested in kind of rainwater capture are people that do have plants that they love, you know, whether it's somebody with a greenhouse full of orchids or somebody who's growing cannabis medicinally or, you know, people who have you know, veggies and they notice how everything perks up after it rains and they want to repeat that over and over again. Or they have, you know, potted plants around their yard. And I mean, we all know that like putting plants into containers, the soil is just, it's like on a constant degradation pattern, and rainwater will not degrade that soil to the same extent that city water will. So it kind of,
and the keeps salts everything. Don't build up. Exactly. Like you get from city water, right?
Exactly. Right. Indoor plants, you know, great for rainwater. So anybody who has a real love of plants really understands how valuable rainwater is. And so that makes it more feasible. But if we were all capturing rainwater on our properties, we would be using less municipal water. I mean, 80% of our water is imported from hundreds of miles away. So there's an energy cost to that, as well as the quality of the water that we're getting, as well as all of the infrastructure we have in place. And so if we are capturing rainwater, we're eliminating some of that infrastructure need and some of that, energy demand. But also when these days, when it rains, sometimes it rains a lot. And our systems were not designed to be able to handle those kinds of events. And so we get flooding, like we had in Mission Valley. Was it last year or the year before, where it was really traumatic? I mean, Mission Valley floods all the time, but I mean, specifically Southeast San Diego had a lot of issues. And so if we were all capturing kind of that first, you know, the first inch or couple inches of rain off of our roofs or keeping it on our properties otherwise, then we would be alleviating the community, you know, loading of those rain events and even the ecosystem loading. You know, it's like when all that storm water goes into the ecosystem, it's shedding, you know, pollution off of our streets and, you know, off of our lawns and all the places we have pesticides and chemicals and, you know, heavy metals and all of that. So by keeping the rainwater on your site, there's less of that stuff washing into the ecosystem. So it's really a community benefit, and it would be ideal if it was a little bit more sponsored by, you know, municipalities. But the cool thing is you can get up to $800 for a rainwater tank from the city of San Diego. You could also capture the county rebate, which is from SoCal Water Smart, up to $350 for city of San Diego. So that's up to $1,150 you can capture in rebates for rainwater tanks. That's not to mention gutter rebates, downspout redirects, things like that. The county, for the unincorporated parts of the county, have a waterscape rebate program. You need to apply for that first before you can get it. The other one you would get retroactively, but this one you have to apply for first. But that one I think is going up to like $3,000 for homeowners in unincorporated parts of the county for rainwater capture, both in tanks and in the ground, which is really awesome. Everybody else in the county, as long as you're not on a well, can get the $350 from the county. So there's some incentive in some places, but really people who are investing in these infrastructures right now are really, they're offsetting, you know, our municipality's water infrastructure needs. They're taking it on themselves personally by investing in rainwater and graywater harvesting. So it'd be nice to see more incentives for those things.
You went right into what I was going to ask you in the last few minutes, was about the rebates. You work with customers as well, right? Helping them with all those rebates or identifying them?
Yeah, some of the rebates are, I mean, it's for your water customer number. So you kind of just have to fill out the information. But what I help people do is figure out how to optimize the rebates for themselves, you know, get the whole rebate. You know, get the largest, most economical system you can for that rebate instead of getting a bunch of 55-gallon barrels and, you know, all the long-term maintenance that goes with that. You know, just get one big tank and it takes up less space and you can get the whole rebate. Also, learning the DIY stuff means that you're putting it in yourself. You're not spending the extra money beyond the rebate. So I help people in the design sense and cost effectiveness of the rebates, but you have to just fill out all the documentation yourself. It's not a lot. It's not onerous. It's not like the lawn replacement rebate programs at all.
So anyone can do it.
Yes.
Okay. We only have a minute left here. So touch on your website again and how people can reach out and touch you and bring you in to help them with their gray water and rainwater capture.
Yeah, we're at catchingh2o.com. If you're interested in a consultation, we have consultation request forms on there. If you have a system and you want some maintenance, we have maintenance request forms on there. We have a workshop coming up on Saturday, which is tomorrow. No, it's tomorrow.
Last week. You had a show. Yeah, you did it last week. Yeah.
And we might have one in October by the time this airs.
And you're going to be teaching a class for us as well.
Yes. I don't remember the date. It's the last week.
September 27th. You'll be teaching a class in Poway. Yes. On rainwater harvesting. So if you want to learn more about what Brooke does, please join us at Poway at 9:30 on the 27th. And with that, we do have classes today in San Diego. The class is Camellias 101 with Constance, who John taught everything apparently. And at 9:30 in Poway, Waterwise Garden and how much and how often to water with our local author, Rich Restuccia, who was with us a few weeks ago. And that's it for Garden Talk today. We look forward to you joining us again next week. Have a great weekend, everybody.
Thank you for listening to Garden Talk by Walter Anderson Nursery, independent and family-owned since 1928. For more information about plants, products, expert advice, news, classes, podcasts, and more, visit walteranderson.com.
We are clear. Good job, George.
Thank you, Todd. We'll catch you later.
Sounds good. Have a great
weekend.
Todd.
Be well.